Welcome back to our second episode of The Ecologist. This month's topic is sustainable tourism. Olivier and I are under the impression that the tourism industry can be quite damaging for local communities who have to alter their way of life to adhere to incoming foreigners. It can put an enormous stress on local land use, increase pollution, and create a local dependency on the industry. The critical awareness surrounding the negative impacts of tourism has brought about conversations about sustainable tourism, which according to the World Tourism Organization is tourism that takes full account of its current and future economic, social, and environmental impacts, addressing the needs of visitors, the industry, the environment, and host communities.
And we are delighted to have two guests here to talk about how to make tourism more sustainable in studio with us. First, Ben Gill, who's been working for Bioregional for more than 15 years. Bioregional is a charity based in London and has the mission to promote sustainable practices among businesses using an impact assessment framework called One Planet Living. Ben has been working on sustainable tourism projects over the past years, making a suitable and interesting guest for this month's episode.
And we are also happy to introduce our very own Pablo, a first-year MIA student in the environmental track. Pablo grew up in Indonesia, therefore he will be giving us a case perspective on how his home country has been affected by tourism.
So we will first start with you, Ben. Thanks for being on the show with us. And as we begin, can you tell us a bit more about yourself and how you got involved with Bioregional and the first place?
Yep, sure. Good morning. So my background is in environmental science. I studied earth science at university. I worked with an engineering firm designing energy efficient schools. I did some environmental education in schools, going into primary schools. And then later on started working with Bioregional. And Bioregional is it's a charity in the UK. I mean, it's a social enterprise that's was really trying to deliver social entrepreneurship before that was a buzzword. So it's always been around setting up about businesses that have a sustainable outcome for the environment, but actually can operate as businesses. And one of the early projects that Bioregional really sort of became known for was developing the UK's first designed to be zero carbon development in London called Bedsead. Which is about 100 homes in South London, had the first car club scheme in London, and they've now become very widely rolled out across all of the UK and Europe. Integrated renewable energy and strategies to reduce waste. And what we saw was that people were having a lower impact on the environment, but actually they were happier and healthier. And we're seeing that actually we're getting an outcome here that's better for the environment, but it's also better for the people who are living there. And learning from that, we developed this framework called One Planet Living, which has 10 principles, which cover technical issues such as zero carbon and zero waste, but also more human-centered issues like health and happiness, culture and community, local economy. And we use that framework on all projects that we work on, really. And then starting from that, we became approached by a number of tourism projects wanting to use the framework, I think because it's a good way of communicating about sustainability as well as designing a project to be sustainable. And for tourism, that is so crucial, is that they need to be able to speak to their guests about what they're trying to do. So I think that's what's attracted the industry to our framework.
Would you say that the One Planet Living framework is similar to the SDGs in some ways?
Yeah, interestingly, the One Planet Living principles, so there's 10 principles, not 17, but they certainly helped inspire the SDGs. One of the founders of Bioregional, she was sort of instrumental in creating the discussion that led to the SDGs, held with, I think, the government of Colombia, the first side event at a UN meeting on the SDG, on what then became the SDGs. So Bioregional were quite involved in the development of the SDGs, particularly the one on the sustainable production and consumption.
Hmm.
12, I think.
Okay.
Wow. That's interesting. And how do you yourself define sustainable tourism?
Yeah, I mean, like you put at the beginning, you mentioned at the beginning, my assumption when working in tourism was that tourism is a fairly negative thing mm-hmm. for the environment and local communities. So it's been enlightening in seeing actually, A, the importance of tourism at an economic level globally. I mean, we can say that it has a negative impact and wish it away, but roughly 1 in 10 jobs in the world and like 8 or 10% of global GDP is linked to tourism. So, mm-hmm. yeah, it can't go anywhere. I think delivering sustainable tourism in actually the place is not too challenging. It's about creating an experience for visitors that's sensitive to the local culture, unique to the local culture, connected to nature and wildlife. It's all deliverable. You know, the big elephant is transport and how people get there. And at the moment, yeah, all the discussions around sustainable tourism do kind of ignore the fact that all the people arriving in these destinations have gone there, have traveled there by train, by plane, mm-hmm. not by train.
Yeah, like when Anna and I were talking about the issue before the interview, before the podcast, we were thinking, is like the question for this episode, is sustainable tourism such a thing? Does it exist currently? Because if we all have to take a flight to go on the other side of the planet, can we really say it's sustainable? So that was a main concern that we have. So maybe I think you've kind of answered these questions in some ways.
I mean, you can have tourism without traveling by plane. And mm-hmm. the problem is we're not supporting those structures, you know, at a national and an international level. So I traveled widely in Europe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, on a lot of, particularly I'd get the train from London to Paris and then get a night train to somewhere. And most of those night trains don't exist anymore. They've closed down because they're not competitive with low-cost airlines, but the low-cost airlines are subsidized. They're not they're not actually lower cost. It's the cost is just hidden. So, sustainable travel is possible and, you know, a business that supports the local economy is possible. So sustainable tourism is definitely possible, but it does need some quite mm-hmm. significant changes in both travel and ensuring that the businesses support the local community and environment.
So yeah, tourism in itself is not a problem. It's more the transport that is. And well, not only this aspect, because we use a lot of plastic bottles when we go in some countries when the water is not drinkable. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, there's a lot of issues around that, I think. So, Ben, you've been working, as I said, for BioRegional for more than 15 years. And you manage the One Planet Living as a framework the company has created to assess these practices. So you've described how it works, how you've came to this framework, but how can you briefly explain the projects you've been doing and how they relate to sustainable tourism?
Yeah, I mean, so One Planet Living, there are many kind of building certification schemes. There are tourism, environmental tourism standards. Our aim with One Planet Living is to create something that's different to those. So unlike a building certification scheme and the tourism standards, there's not a list of things you have to do. Mm-hmm. We are trying to work with a project for them to think about what they need to achieve to be sustainable, what sustainability means for that project, and then develop a plan to achieve that. And then, again, crucially quite different to building certification schemes, we want people to report on how they're doing in operation. Most certification schemes for buildings stop once the building is complete. And I think for tourism industries, that's much more obvious that you are going to carry on reporting because they're going to own and operate the building, whereas other construction sectors don't. So I think, you know, that's one, and again, another reason why tourism industries came to us. And the first one that really worked with for many years is Village Nature, which is a joint venture between Pierre et Vacances and Euro Disney, next to Disneyland Paris. And I've been working on that for almost 15 years, I guess. So they approached Bioregional around about the time I joined, and they had the concept of wanting to make this new resort based around sustainability and a sustainable experience for guests, but also to operate as sustainably as possible. And they'd already identified that there was a geothermal aquifer that the resort is sort of sitting on, and they'd identified that, okay, we want to use that aquifer and use that to heat a water park. And that infrastructure has now been delivered. It actually delivers hot water, not just for Village Nature, but for Disney itself, and so has had a positive impact there. But you know, linking to the transport issue, that area is accessible to roughly 50 million people within a few hours by train. And so suddenly you've got a tourism experience that's open all year round, that people can get to by train. They don't have to fly to, they don't have to drive to, they can swim outside all year in a geothermally heated lagoon. To me, it is giving a model that asks, can tourism be sustainable? Well, to me, this really shows that it can be. There's still lots to do there. There's further to go, but it shows that if you get the infrastructure right, you put it in the right place, and you set the right vision, then of course you can have a sustainable project.
So that kind of draws on what we were going to ask. So drawing on this project, Les Villages Nature Paris, would you say those are the elements that you look for in a sustainable tourism project, or are there key? What are the key steps when you're drawing out sustainable tourist projects abroad? What are things that you try to put in place in order to keep it sustainable?
I mean, they're very different. It depends on where the place is. Mm-hmm. Other schemes we've worked on are projects in new development projects in Portugal, in the UK, and in countries in Africa. Getting the infrastructure right is crucial. Whatever infrastructure you put in at the start is you're going to be using for years. So making sure that is going to enable the resort to operate sustainably going forward is going to be one of the things you need to get right from the outset. Thinking about the building materials, I think people, there's a lot of focus on making sure buildings are efficient. Linking to the impacts of the local community, there's much less thought until recently about, where do these materials come from and what's the impact of that? We're seeing that the use of river sand is in less developed countries, it's just being dug out of the rivers. It's just an ecosystem that's essentially being taken away to build buildings with. So, we need to make sure that all of these things are considered from the outset. And then I think the biggest, if you look at what's the opportunity with tourism, it's to give people an experience when they're outside of their daily life, when they're probably in a more open-minded space, and show them what sustainability is, show them what nature is, create that connection for them, help them see help them see nature for what it is and how we are a part of that. And if then they can take some of that home, then that project has had a truly beneficial impact. So how do we embed that experience into the guest experience of their stay at the resort or at the hotel?
And so far from what I see in the Les Villages Nature Paris project is that you're focusing a lot on the environmental impact of the vacation center, but you talked earlier about happiness and those kind of things. How do they assess these aspects of sustainable tourism? Is it a continuous work that you have to do with them to assess everything, every dimensions of sustainability from their project? How does it work concretely?
Yeah, so health and happiness. Sort of take a little step back. I mean, the One Planet Living principles. We said there are 10 principles, and we used to have them with at the top to have zero carbon and zero waste and sustainable materials. These are a lot of the time we're talking with architects and engineers, and these are what they want to talk about. And actually, about 7 years ago, we turned them upside down so that there's health and happiness at the top and equity and local economy, because if you're talking to people, that is what people are interested in. They want to know, how is this project going to make my life better? They're not really interested in the technical standards of the building. Health and happiness, I mean, it's, in a way, you could say it's the, if you've delivered the other 9 principles, then the outcome should be healthy and happy for the people visiting. In terms of what we ask people to do, it really depends on the project and where it is. Projects in rural Africa, what they need to do around, or what they can do around supporting local health and happiness is very different from a project in Paris, on the outskirts of Paris. But it does primarily focus on the employees, the people they work with, their supply chain, their stakeholders. How are they, what are their employment like, right? What are their employment rights? How are they ensuring their safety and well-being, both physical and mentally at work? Obviously, it applies to the guest as well. I mean, it's one does hope that if people are on holiday, the aim of the tourist business is to make those people happy. So that should be part of what's happening. But obviously, we want to know the guest's satisfaction. We want to ensure that buildings are healthy from any of the materials that are used, that there's no gases that are unhealthy for people staying there.
And so you were talking about Africa. You have another important project on sustainable tourism there. It's called Singita Serengeti. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it well. It's located in Tanzania. And it has been using the One Planet Living Index for some years now. And on your website, you describe it as a wildlife reserve, as a world-leading example of sustainable upmarket tourism. And what have been the actions taken to make it sustainable, to make it a world-leading example?
Yeah, I mean, going right back to your comments about can tourism be sustainable? When we first became involved in very upmarket tourism in Africa, there was certainly deep skepticism that this can be a sustainable thing. This can be an approach that's beneficial for the world as a whole. We started first working with Singita Serengeti, I think, in 2012. The Singita Serengeti is a partnership between Singita, which is a tourism organization, and the Grameti Fund, which is a conservation organization. And the partnership between the two is aiming to use tourism and use partnerships with other people who want to be involved in conservation and tourism to fund conservation in the area. And the project is right on the boundaries of the Serengeti National Park. In Tanzania, you have national parks, and then there's game reserves, are kind of the next level down. In a game reserve, you have people basically get the license to hunt in that area of land. They manage that area of land and they can hunt there. They can shoot the animals. The partners in the project do put together a number of game reserves and also some village land, and basically created a private national park on the boundary of the national park, in effect extending the national park, use the revenue from tourism and their partnerships to put conservation measures to manage the land, put in anti-poaching. There's like 180 guards, scouts who are patrolling the land to protect the animals there. it's taken a long time to transition from the community being implicated in the poaching. A lot of, you know, just for them, poaching was not poaching was hunting for food. It's not trophy poaching or poaching for poaching to sell things abroad. It did, you know, it was what they ate. So actually giving them an alternative revenue stream so that they didn't have to live off poaching has been part of the project as well. So it's really for them, they've really been saying how, if you're going to protect the animals, you've got to provide jobs and services and an economy for the local mm-hmm. people, and tourism can be helping fund that. There was one other sort of interesting pilot for me in thinking how tourism can have a benefit is actually the density of tourism there is very low. There's very few camps in the area, but actually for the conservation team, having tourism camps is helpful for anti-poaching because it's more people on the ground, it's more eyes, and actually if you get the right density of tourism, it is a benefit to conservation. That we're always, I think we're very aware of kind of over-tourism and these images of, you know, tens of cars surrounding one lion and people, and that's obviously negative. But if we have the balance right, then the tourism industry can support conservation efforts.
And not to put you completely on the spot, but I am slightly a bit skeptical of this project as a development student. I think we often hear how problematic sometimes intervention from the global north, particularly in parts of the global south, can be problematic because consultants might not properly understand the needs of the community. So I'm wondering how throughout this project you took into account some of those needs and how they were integrated into the process to better understand how tourism can be sustainable in that region, considering your
companies. I mean, it's, you know, I think your skepticism is well-founded. That's fine. I think, just to maybe, I feel I haven't quite answered Olivier's question, sort of what did we do on the Serengeti project was around ensuring that their operations were sustainable. So how do they manage their waste? How do they manage their water, generate renewable energy? Now when we arrived, they basically didn't have a waste management plan. Now pretty much all of their waste is recycled. There is no, you know, it's a location of Africa where there aren't really recycling facilities. Everything needs to be dealt with there. And there's basically no waste that comes out of the project. The water's well managed. They've got a lot more renewable energy on site. So that's what we've been working with them on, and actually just building the understanding in staff. One of the things about that is diet, which I'd like to come on to in a bit. Mm-hmm. The question about the local community. So we weren't involved in the outset. The Grometti Fund, which is the conservation arm, and they have a whole community outreach team. They've been working with the community from the outset. It's challenging. You know, the problem with, you say the community, that's not one thing, that's mm-hmm. not one voice. It has many opinions, and there are inevitably going to be going to be challenges. I think that, you know, broadly, this has been very, they have been successful by really looking at how the project can help build a local economy. So by putting the tourism bringing in these people, tourism, but also the conservation people, they buy each year over $300,000 worth of local produce from the local community. And they've helped the local community build the capacity to provide, to be able to provide that produce because they need it. But, you know, it then puts all of that money into the local community, which with the multiplier effect, you know, it benefits, you know, not just the people they buy from. So that's the aspect I've seen. I've worked on some of their Singita's newer projects. So they have a project they just started in Rwanda. And there's, from the outset, they've had to negotiate with the local community. It's land that was village land. They need to ensure that the local community are happy with the transaction, that they are going to benefit from the business that's set up there and get the jobs that they expect. Yeah, there's always a challenge between how long projects take to come to fruition and how quickly the local communities have sort of expected the benefits to come. So, there are always challenges, but I think if you go in with the idea of that this is going to create an economy locally, then you're in a strong starting point, and then be very sensitive to what are the local customs and how you're going to fit into that and make that part of the tourism experience. So you want to make sure that when people are in Tanzania or in Rwanda or in wherever they know they're there. They're not just in generic luxury lodge in some white Africa experience. That it has that it is based in that local culture.
And you mentioned briefly diet, and I was in Botswana quite recently, and there's all these anti-poaching laws, as you mentioned, but actually in Botswana, it's created an overpopulation of elephants, and elephants are quite damaging to the local flora.
Ecosystems.
Yeah, the ecosystems, because they eat so much, and when you think of how big they are, how many people that could feed. So it's quite interesting hearing that debate, because it's not what you hear from Western media, and they kind of criminalize and point fingers at poachers, but yet that's their culture in a sense, and that's what they've known for years, and they don't do it to harm or to make money. It's more for subsistence. So maybe, yeah, you can touch a bit on the case in Tanzania with diets.
The point you put up there is really human-wildlife conflict, which is what they're trying to manage and minimize. As populations of large animals, large mammals, whether they're predators or large herbivores, that has an impact on the local community. In some places, their remains hunting, the local community can hunt, or animals are hunted and given to the local community. That's kind of part of the transaction. I think what we're trying to look at from a diet perspective and a cultural perspective, and we hope this isn't kind of say northern cultural imperialism, globally we have to move from a carnivore-led diet to a plant-based diet. We can't feed 7 billion people hamburgers every day. We need to be eating a much more plant-based diet. And in these conservation areas, you can see that the biggest pressure on conservation is often herding of farm animals on the boundaries of the property. Mm. So, and if you're buying meat locally, it's coming from that activity that is in direct conflict with your conservation activities. So what we're working with on the project itself is how you, for the guests, I'd say it's not really an issue that that high-end tourists now are so into wellness and healthiness and therefore healthy eating that's very much part of it. Actually, it's the staff. Where the culture can be really based around eating meat, and how do you challenge that? How do you get people to see that it's not good for their health, but also it's not good for the environment or for the conservation? And then when you start trying to have that look then at the community, so in Tanzania, there was no culture of growing produce. That was they're a herding culture. That's what they do, but that isn't going to be sustainable as the population grows, as the land becomes less fertile. So they are going to need to change. And I think that the role of the any tourism project coming in there is to help that transition. And then on the other hand, if you go to Rwanda, their entire culture is around horticulture, farmer, small gardens. The array of local vegetables and produce is amazing. So there's much less need to focus on that. But I think we, you know, globally, that issue around meat and diet is so crucial that we have to wrap it into any kind of sustainable any project if it's going to be sustainable, and you know, tourism is part of that.
Yeah, but I would argue also that you look at America and they're probably some of the biggest meat consumers in the world. So I think they probably need to change before we go and start asking communities in developing countries to change their habits. I don't know.
It's true. The problem is
us.
The problem is us. And when we talk about One Planet Living, we're going into rural Africa and talking about One Planet Living, and you know, it's One Planet Living. It comes from ecological footprint analysis showing that, you know, the average European, if we all lived like the average European, we'd need three planets of resources.
Yeah.
Like the average American, it's five. The average Tanzanian, it's like a half or a.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the way we talk about it is if you look at human development and ecological footprint as a graph, one of them on each axis, you plot the countries on it, and you can even plot a country over time. Human development increases as ecological footprint increases, as consumption increases, human development increases, and then it basically reaches an inflection point where consumption continues increasing, but human well-being doesn't really increase. So One Planet Living is about kind of development stopping at that inflection point or returning to that inflection point. And when we're talking about One Planet Living with local people in Tanzania, we're saying that yes, or Rwanda, or in these communities, consumption and footprint can and should be growing to drive up human development. But we need to try and plan for it to stay in this sustainable area rather than take off into the northern paradigm where we're consuming way more. And then on top of that, I mean, it's just a health thing. In those local communities, eating meat is seen as wealthy. One of the benefits of working for this organization is you get fed there. You get fed meat every single meal. They want to have meat every single meal because that's, you know, that shows a good quality of life. But that's just not healthy. Mm-hmm. And we need to be educating people about, you know, what's good for their health, and not just letting cultural practices outside of their normal parameters kind of influence the way that people live. We never used to eat meat in the north every single day. It was what we did at celebrations, but now it's become something we do every single day, and we're trying to change, you know, people are changing back from that. They don't. Mm. We're trying to return to something whereby it's you eat good meat a few times a week or a few times a month, whatever fits your way of wanting to live. Does that
No. Yeah.
I think it's common sense, yeah, to what you're saying. What one recurrent theme that you're talking about is the importance of raising awareness to the impact, the environmental impact, the social impacts of tourism, and regardless of the projects you're working on. And I've read an article, a blog article that you wrote on how about the responsibility of governments to promote and to raise awareness regarding sustainable tourism. You went in the hiking with your, with your family in Mont Blanc, and you realized that in the refuge there was nothing about the environmental impacts of the melting glaciers there. And can you say a word about that? What's the role? What would be the role of governments to raise awareness?
Well, I mean, I suppose there it was governments because the refuges are kind of all part of a government-run association. I think it's more if you look at the changes that are required in this decade, if we're going to prevent catastrophic climate change and kind of ecosystem collapse, we need to be using every single lever there is out there to make change and engage with people. And you know, many opportunities there don't seem to be being taken. If you can go to a tourism project in Africa, and you can have people there who don't realise that poaching is happening. They don't know there's rhino poaching or elephant poaching, and if they have gone there and they've gone on holiday and they leave and they still don't know about it, that would seem like it's a failure of some levels. And I think, you know, it's the same with climate change. If people are in as part of their holiday, they're in a place from which they should be able to see the real-time impacts of climate change. This is not something that's happening in the future now. We've just had the hottest winter ever in the Alps in France. The Antarctic hit 20 degrees in its summer just this year. You know, it's happening today, but it's trying to make people see that. And often when you're on holiday or on tourism, you are much more outside, much more in nature. And those, therefore, we should be trying to help people see what is happening around them. The government, you know, governments have a role to play in that as part of their communication campaigns that they do.
And then maybe to bring this discussion into current day news, I'm kind of curious because some of these communities are so dependent on the tourism industry, and with everything going on right now with the virus, a lot of tourism is slowing down. So what can communities do when they're so dependent on this one source of income to help diversify?
It comes full circle then back to we talked about at the beginning, and transport is if you're overly reliant on international tourism, it's the most fickle industry there can be. So when there was the Ebola outbreak of 2012, maybe-ish, the number of tourists visiting Tanzania plummeted. There was more Ebola in Europe and North America than there was in East Africa. Yeah, it was in West Africa. It wasn't. But people were scared. They didn't know. They didn't go. And so tourism collapses for logical and illogical reasons. The more you're looking at kind of local tourism, you're plugged into people who can get there by trains and not so reliant on mass tourism that can be cancelled by, you know, kind of mass hysteria, then you're going to have a more robust economy. That's, you know, tourism's still going to be a part of it, but it's not entirely reliant on huge numbers of people coming the entire time to make it work.
I think it would be a good moment to introduce Pablo before talking more about sustainable tourism. Hey, Pablo, how are you?
Good. How are you, Oli?
I'm good, thank you. Maybe you want to introduce yourself a little bit, and like you're from Indonesia, and briefly start presenting the case you wanted to present us today.
Yeah, so I've been born and grown in Jakarta, but my both parents are coming from the other part of the archipelago. And tourism is a big sector in Indonesia's economy. Like in 2018, the contribution of tourism to Indonesia's GDP is almost 4%, almost 5%. It's about like $20 billion. So it's a big, big industry. And when you talk about tourism, of course, you know about Bali. Bali is more well-known than Indonesia for some people. And we can talk about the right case about mass tourism is, of course, Bali. And it's already happening since 40 years ago. And the growth of tourism, especially for foreign tourism coming to Bali, has made it that Bali is fully dependent on mass tourism, for better or for worse. That's the fact. And that's going to be always happening in the future.
And we talked about the government roles to raise awareness on the impact of tourism. When we see that a country is so dependent on tourism and a specific region particularly, how can they manage this role of, you know, they both profit from the industry, but they're also impacted. The local community is impacted by tourism. How do you see this issue?
To present Bali as a tourism case is a very, very important one, because tourism in Bali has created jobs and incomes for millions of Indonesians, and not only Balinese, because people from the other islands, Java, West Nusa Tenggara, like all from the other islands, they come to Bali to make a living, who they kind of have a hard time to find income elsewhere in their own islands. So on the other hand, the problem with Bali right now is much more on the environmental impact. There is almost 30 million plastic bottles being thrown away every month in Bali.
Every month, okay.
Every month. And yeah, especially it's also because in Indonesia, you need to buy a drinking water in a bottle, of course. And the other problem right now that's Bali already feeling like very, very critical problem is the traffic. So these both problems is the most critical one. But the good news is Bali's government, because they know and they realize that they are very, very dependent on tourism. So to give you a bit fact that Bali has 4 million populations, the whole island. And every year there are like 4 million foreign tourists coming there and 8 million domestic tourists. So it'd be like 300% of the population.
Three times the population.
Three times the population. And because of this, like their government, their local provincial government is fully aware of this, and they are making very, very good, significant policies, I can say, that 2 years ago in 2018, they already make a provincial rule of banning the use of plastic bags, because you know, that's one of the contributor for all the plastic pollutions, not only sourced in Bali, but also coming from the other islands, or even foreign tourists sometimes coming from after visiting the other islands, and then they bring like mineral water and all the other things. So this is a very, very, I think they are the first province to ban plastic use in the whole Indonesia, and now some other province also, like Jakarta just followed a few months back. So it's a very, very good start. And for the local community, there is a lot of NGOs who are trying to raise awareness on this. Like they're almost routinely every week, every month, they make a beach cleanup especially in the southern part of Bali, where the peak of the tourists is there. One thing that they are still, I think, trying very, very complicated issue is the traffic, because so this is a very complicated case to balance between environmental protections and also how to give the solutions for the local income. For example, in Indonesia right now, there is a huge growing boom of startup, a tech startup. We have our own startup companies. It's called Gojek. It's like Uber in the US. So it's basically a ride sharing, and it can be cars, it can be motorcycles. And this will help a bit on decreasing the traffic, also because Bali has not so advanced public transport. And this is because since 30, 40 years ago, the local communities, they try to build all this, being a local driver for one families coming in, using motorcycle rentals and those kind of things, making the traffic much worse, and of course more air pollutions on that. And ever since 40 years ago, there is no railroad in Bali, and so this is a kind of direction that the central government in Jakarta and also the provincial government, they're like debating how to make this better without killing the local economy, especially most of the Balinese commoners who are very dependent on transportations sectors by giving service to the foreigners or even to domestic tourists.
And maybe you can quickly touch on, you said your friend has been organizing a responsible tourism project. Mm. So what does that entail exactly?
Yeah, so there is this, this case is not in Bali, so it's on the South Sumatra. The project is called Berdaya Krui. It's a project that funded also by the UNDP Youth Collab in Southeast Asia. They are trying to create a pilot project of complete responsible, sustainable tourism in those areas. Krui is one of the emerging tourist destinations. It's well known for the surfers because it has a very good wave on the southern of Sumatra. And they are trying to build this fully integrated and sustainable tourism pilot project, where one of the most important thing I can say is they're stressing much on the local supply chain sourcing. This is a very important thing for me, because if you want to start speaking about sustainable tourism, of course there are consumers on the other on one part and also the producers on the other part. And to create an awareness for consumers, it means ourselves, like especially people probably from the global north who are going to these tropical paradise and trying to buy things, handicraft or all the things. But from the producing side, this is the most important thing to start maximize the local sourcing from the local producers, local neighborhood. It can be food, it can be biodegradable soap and shampoo, and it can be like handicraft. That's the most important thing from my point of view to create a fully sustainable. And it can be this small pilot project like Berdaya Krui can be a good example for the other parts of Indonesia. It is an emerging tourism destinations, and also the central governments, they realize that Bali has been very packed with mass tourism, so they tried to create what is called the 10 new Bali. I don't know if it would create more problems or more or more solutions, but at least the intention is to disperse the potential of tourism industry, not only very much focused in Bali, but also all the entire archipelago.
So to diffuse the impact of the diffuse, I don't know if the right word.
So, Pan, I was really interested. I don't know anything about Bali, really. never been. Really interesting that there's twice the number of local tourists as foreign tourists. Mm-hmm. I just wondered, like, if we were to try and imagine what sustainable tourism in you know, I think you wouldn't be able to just say Bali. It would have to be
Indonesia.
Kind of Indonesia would look like. I mean, what would that look like? Would it just, is the problem just the concentration in Bali? How do we create a sustainable tourism vision for Indonesia? And I'm curious what you think it would look like.
It's a very good question, because if you're talking about the mode of transport, it is complicated, because you know that Indonesia is an archipelago, so the easiest way to connect to each of the other islands is by plane, it's by air transport. And I also think that, and locally, nationally, and also globally, the aviation industry should play a bigger role in making this sustainable tourism into reality. Because how many the emissions that come from the jet fuels, they have to offset those carbon footprints. We know that some of the Ireland airlines industry in Europe already start to think about, should we like plant some trees or whichever solutions to solve that. But if we say then from the transportation point of view, it's still quite complicated, because even for domestic tourists, for Jakarta, for example, if you want to go to Bali without using planes, you need probably more than 12 hours ride of train, and then you cross the strait to Bali. So it's still quite less effective, you can say. But from other point of view, I think the importance of environmental awareness from the consumers is very, very much important in this case. Consumers hold the key roles on making sustainable tourism work. It's because we know when the consumers demand more sustainable output from the tourism sectors, whether it's from the way they stay in the hotels or villas, what they consume, what they buy, then the suppliers will provide it. It's a nature of economy. And I see a great potential in Indonesian population as well, because with the growing middle class, there is a more growing awareness on environmental impact, especially most of the tourists from the biggest cities like Jakarta, Surabaya, or the other island. And I think probably in the future, with more growing awareness on environmental impact, the domestic tourists can have more solutions for this, because it goes from the consumers, I think.
And maybe just to sort of wrap up the conversation, if both of you can speak on what you see the sustainable tourism industry or the tourism industry in general, how it might change in the next 25 years.
Oh, challenging question. The next 25 years, for me, I think I can only speak the case from Indonesia, because with the amount of population we have now, it's almost 270 million people. Probably in 25 years, I don't know if it's reached 300 million. I don't know. But I think on the next 25 years, with the growing middle class, growing economy, more development in all of developing countries, more local people will be able to become tourists in their own countries. And it can be a better or worse, depends on their awareness on environmental impact, their awareness on how you want to preserve this place as you see it now. Because sometimes when you come to visit, probably Ubud, one of the very, very strong local tourism spot in Bali, you come now and you're coming back 25 years from now and you see it very, very much different. It will create a bad feeling in your heart, like, wow, I miss the old Bali, for example. So when you have that sense of belongings with your own country, you will have this greater urgency to preserve it the way it is, and to be sustainable is one of the way.
Mm-hmm. I like that. And Ben?
I think it has to be more local. It's sort of impossible to see how we can retain such an international model of tourism in a sustainable world. There's no solution for zero carbon planes on the horizon. I don't know if there is on a 25-year horizon, but certainly not in the much shorter term. So I think it has to become more local. I think it will become more, because of that, more around, as a, even beyond conservation, but actually more regeneration based, about we want to go on as part of our holiday and we want to participate in something that is helping to rebuild our local community, our local project, our local wildlife area. So I think it will hopefully become a more participatory experience. It'll be local. There will still be, you know, big international projects, but I think there will be less the dominant way that tourism is done. Hopefully there'll be fewer cruise ships, but that's
these are really
polluting.
That
will be another. That will be a whole nother discussion.
And I think the key thing here is to have a bigger, more important collective consciousness about the impact of tourism. Exactly. And I think you, you Ben, with Bioriginal, are doing a great job with that, raising awareness, bring the impacts and on people conscious. And I think well, Pablo, Indonesia is trying progressively to raise awareness as well, trying to create an infrastructure, which is quite positive. Maybe on that note, we should wrap up this episode. And before saying the conclusion, we every month, we and during the episode, we have a monthly challenge. So to that we launch to our audience and between Anna and I. So last month was about trying to eat locally. How did it go for you, Anna? Have you been able to eat locally?
Well, to be honest, I don't think I've done the challenge justice. It's winter here, so it's hard to find accessible produce that is locally made, besides potatoes and carrots and maybe some cheese. It has made me a bit more conscious, at least while I'm shopping, to look out for those Swiss labels. But unfortunately, it's been a busy month and it's been a little harder to integrate that. What about you?
Yeah, the same for me. And I think I've been able to identify the main challenges regarding local food, like to buy local food, is also the price. We are students and yeah, it costs a lot of money. So that was my main barrier to really be able to eat locally. So yeah, I don't know how our audience have been able to go through this challenge. We, if you have any feedback on this, it would be great to have it. If you can send it to our email address or social media platform. And for this month, I think Pablo has come with the new challenge for next month.
Well, because we talk about sustainable tourism this month, and it's quite challenging times for us to go traveling. But I think what I'm gonna give you guys and all the audience for challenge is, when you try to plan your next trip, whether it's a short or a long haul trip, try to measure your sustainability impact by the choice of your transportations. And also, when you come to a place, research more on whether like these restaurants or these souvenirs or handicraft shop are produced or sourced locally. Are they giving a good impact on sustainability and on the local environment? So I think that's the challenge. In general, like, be a more responsible tourist.
If I could just fold something into that, you know, from a bioregional perspective. So we have the 10 One Planet Living Principles, which cover many of those things. Maybe as the next, as the challenge, like, take the, when you go on your holiday, take those with you and have a look at them and see if you can do something that relates to each of the principles as part of your holiday. It might just help expand the experience, but also make you aware of both the positive and negative impacts of tourism.
Great, thank you. We'll definitely keep that in mind over the next month as we're stuck here in Switzerland. But thank you again, both, for taking the time
You're
to be
welcome.
On the show. You've provided some great perspectives on both of your projects and respective perspectives from where you're from and where you work. Anything else to add?
It was a pleasure to have you. And please stay safe. It's a hard time for everyone. We've just learned yesterday at the Graduate Institute that all the courses are canceled, all public events, and it's I think it's the same everywhere else in the world. So please, guys, be careful, stay safe, stay home, and I hope you can enjoy, you still enjoy our podcast episode with us.
And stay healthy.
Yeah, stay healthy, exactly. Thank you, guys. Goodbye.